Good. Good morning, everybody. Can I invite some people to come a little closer? Well, it's a very good morning. Elections, I gather Vancouver had a very favorable result. I suspect it might be one of the reasons why some of the regulars are not here. They probably were up a lot late watching the election. I'd also like to say that it's wonderful to see so many new faces. It's also wonderful to see old and dear friends as well. I'm just curious, how many people are here for the first time? And how many people are here just for the begin? They haven't been here during the practice period. Yeah. So there's quite a number of newbies. In Zen, beginner's mind is really what you're trying to. That's the place you're trying to be. So it's really a very favorable position to be a beginner, because you're. Perspective is fresh. So the theme for the practice period has been, or is, suffering and resilience. The practice period, for those of you who are not familiar, is an 8-week period where we intensify our practice. It began with a weekend retreat in September and will end with a week-long retreat at Loon Lake, which happens in mid-November. So we're just slightly past the halfway mark. All of the talks for the practice period are online, and I'm somebody who's out of town, so I take advantage of them. They're wonderful talks. They're wonderful talks. So it's really worth listening to. When I first heard that the theme was suffering and resilience for the practice period, I thought, oh, that's just great, because suffering is something that I relate very closely to. And then when Kate asked to, if I would be willing to do a talk, I said, fine. And I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to focus in on suffering. And I think that's because suffering is oh so familiar. I think suffering is something that I think is really top of mind for a lot of us. Suffering or dissatisfaction. Suffering can be sometimes a fairly grand term for what seems like, the petty dissatisfactions in life. Not to say that there isn't, people don't face real and serious circumstances and that sort of thing. But I think for a lot of us in the West, we live fairly fortunate lives. But nevertheless, that sense of dissatisfaction is something that's pervasive. It's pervasive in our society, maybe even more so, actually, than in some of the countries where I lived in West Africa for a while, and where there is, the really hardcore suffering that comes with poverty. But in some ways, I'm not sure that people suffered the same sort of discontent, anxiousness that is quite pervasive in our country. When I started researching the topic, I found myself more and more interested in the other part of it, which is resilience. And as I thought about it, I thought about how throughout my life, I have always really sought out people who were showing really signs of being highly resilient. That's something that I find very inspiring to be around. And also stories of people who have, sort of faced very difficult circumstances and have in some way sort of triumphed from them. So I'd like to begin with a story of a woman that is who is really a model for me of resilience. So I have a number of friends here from the same co-op that I spent a lot of years in, and so this will be familiar to all of you. Lynn is a woman who's approximately my age. She was first diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when she was 25, although her doctor probably knew that she had multiple sclerosis before that. And she had a very aggressive type of multiple sclerosis that quickly left her in a wheelchair. And Lynn has a very indomitable spirit. So this was many years ago, but the building that she lived in, they were putting in a new elevator. And she lived on, I believe, the third floor. And the elevator was literally took a few months before it was finally in. And she was absolutely not content to be at home for that period of time. She was somebody who was very active. And so she started asking her friends to help carry her in her wheelchair down the back stairs. And I remember, I can still to this day remember going down the back stairs with Lynn. There was two of us. And it was very frightening because it was just at the very edge of what I could do. And I didn't want to drop her, nor did I want to, you know, injure myself. So predictably, she ran through her friends relatively quickly. So the next place that she went for assistance was across the street to a fairly trendy restaurant that was just across the street from a fitness center. So there was a lot of jocks that used to hang out at this restaurant. And so she asked around who was willing to give her a hand. And a number of them came to the forefront and said they would, and they too fell by the wayside pretty quickly. Not to be discouraged, she's called the fire department. Mm-hmm. And the fire department turned up to carry her down the stairs and back, and actually I think they sort of incorporated it into a training routine that they were doing. So the thing that really impressed me about this was that although Lynn did not have a body that had the strength to get her where she wanted to go, she had the courage and the tenacity to really ask for the help that she needed. And that has been something that I've seen of her. And not only just for herself, she's also been a big advocate for the needs of people with disabilities. Just this last fall, she was out visiting. Her father was dying. She lives in Toronto now, and she was in a motor vehicle accident. She was in a taxi, and the taxi was sideswiped on the freeway. And it turns out that taxis are not required, the handicapped taxis are not required to have shoulder straps. And because she didn't have a shoulder strap on, she hurt herself quite badly. Her body went forward and all the soft muscle tissue was really, really hurt. She was really hurt in this. And about 10 days or 2 weeks after the accident, I was visiting with her. She was staying in Sydney while her body recovered. And we were walking over to a health clinic. She was in her wheelchair. We had to walk in the street because all the bumps on the sidewalk would just send her into sort of spasms of pain. And I was thinking to myself how, having been with her all these years, how I become really aware of all the issues that went into mobility and accessibility when you didn't have a totally normal body. And I said that to her. I said, you know, Lynn, one of the things that I really appreciate is how you've really helped me to become conscious, to become aware of the limitations that go with a disability. And she said, well, that's what I'm in this world to do. And that ability to frame her circumstances as what she was, that's what she was doing in this world. She was a living example of how you can be resilient with a very, very difficult situation. She's quadriplegic now. So the things that Lynn exemplifies for me, the qualities in a highly resilient person. The first is that they're not defined by their life circumstances. Of course, they're affected by them. But who they are, they see themselves in a much larger context. Their attitude is one of optimism and courage. The third thing is that they are deeply connected to others, and they ask for the support that they need. They're concerned about the needs of others and see themselves in a larger context. And their limitation or hindrance is often transformed into a sense of purpose or meaning in their life. So, resilience. How do we navigate this life of suffering and joy? How do we find and maintain our center and stay focused on what really matters to us? So where does the term resilience come from? It's interesting because the term actually comes from the Latin word salire, which means to jump. And it first came into the English language in about the 17th century, and it was an experimenter, Francis Bacon, who was working with metal. So it is actually a metal, it comes out of metallurgy. And it means that it is the quality of a substance to be able to regain its shape after it has been, it's been stressed. Resilience is almost becoming a buzzword now. You know, resilience is sort of taking the place of mindfulness. Well, it's not taking the place of it, but it's such a popular word now in science. Resilience is used to describe how our body maintains health or regains it in the case of an injury. And it's like our autoimmune system. If we didn't have an autoimmune system that kept us basically well or really helped us to regain our health, we would all be dead at this point. So in psychology, it's used to describe how our psyche returns to our original state of well-being after a trauma. In spiritual traditions, it can be seen as the energy that helps us to turn our suffering into the path of enlightenment. Kate gave a very good definition, I thought, during the opening retreat for this practice, and she said that resilience is the capacity to maintain one's core values and integrity in the face of change. So my definition: when things are going well, it's what supports and sustains our sense of well-being. When we've lost our equilibrium, resilience is what enables our body and mind to regain health and well-being. And then there's a third category. When things are really difficult and can't be changed, It's the capacity to endure with grace and equanimity. There's a famous author, Viktor Frankl, who was a psychologist, and he was a he went through the concentration camps. And he said that there were three things that gave meaning to life. And the first was productivity, an ability to engage in your world and do something. And the second was social relationships. But the third was the one that I find sort of most interesting. And he said it was the capacity to endure suffering with dignity. Because sometimes suffering actually can't be avoided, you know. And the ability to endure is with some grace and some dignity is really what gives that meaning to life. Another example was in Sierra Leone, where my friend Anne and I both spent a number of years. Sierra Leone is in West Africa. There was a Creole phrase that was used quite often, and it was "Au for do we for bia," which means "What can you do about it? We'll bear it," which really summed up what a lot of people had to do a lot of the time. And so science, psychology, and spiritual traditions come from different perspectives when looking at resilience, but it's surprising the amount of agreement there is between them. First, what is the basis of our sense of well-being? Well, people have an innate quality of that is set at birth, unique to each individual, and this sense of well-being can be altered and can be trained by our mind, how we focus our mind. In Buddhism, we're taught that we are innately Buddha. So that is the basic quality of our existence, that we're already fully realized beings, and that is the reference point. That's the main reference point. That's where you can get back to. The other thing that science talks about is that they all talk about is that we are all innately drawn to kindness or goodness. There was a very interesting experiment that they did with 6-month-old infants, and they had a little video that they watched. Okay, so there was this little toy duck, and this duck is trying to get into a box and keeps lifting the box up and down and up and down, and there are two bears, okay, and so one of the bears comes over and helps the duck open the box, okay, and then goes back. And then the second bear comes over, and he sits on the box, and the duck can't get into the box. Then they gave these infants the choice of which bear did they want to hold. And they overwhelmingly held the one that helped the duck. So that's at 6 months of age. You know, it would be hard to devise an experiment that went much earlier than that. But we're social animals. We're drawn to those people that are open and kind towards us. Makes perfect sense. So while we begin with an innate sense of well-being and the characteristic of kindness, the slings and arrows of life seem to distort our perceptions. We often view ourselves and others from our wounds and our more limited self. How do we respond to trauma or difficult situations? Well, some people, I'm just going to sip of water. some people, when faced with really difficult circumstances, actually don't return to a sense of well-being. They dip down and they don't recover from it. Other people do regain their original sense of well-being. This is what really is called resilience, after a short or a long period of time. Some people actually, their experience of difficulty will actually be a springboard towards growth. And it's called post-traumatic growth. I find this a very optimistic, a very hopeful term. But when you think about it, you can probably come up with many examples of this. Do all of you know about Rick Hansen? No? Yes? Okay, Rick Hansen was a young man who lost the use of his legs. I think he was just a teenager when that happened. And he did an around-the-world trip in a wheelchair. It took him 3 years. And I remember being, and actually for the first 2.5 years while he wasn't in Canada, he was only crossing Canada for the last 6 months, there was really very little press. There was very little interest in what he was doing. So, you know, you think of the 2.5 years of trudging on. I happened to walk outside Woodward's department store when he passed by on his way to BC Place, where he had where he was finishing his tour. I was overwhelmed. I mean, I found myself just with tears in my eyes. You know, the impact, the thought of what this person had endured, and here he was at the end of it, and he's gone on to do wondrous things with his life. You know, Vancouver is one of the leading cities in the world in terms of accessibility. A lot of that has to do with Rick Hansen. Another place where you see, you look at these groups like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Most of these groups have begun by somebody who's suffered a really big loss in their life, you know, their child or someone, and that's been the thing that's motivated them to make some sense of that personal tragedy by making it something that's more important than just what happened to their loved one, you know, so that perhaps it won't happen to somebody else. There's also a fourth group, and these people are pretty rare, and actually they don't respond to trauma in the same way as everybody else. Now, these people were high-level meditators, 30,000 hours. But they did not go through the same shock response. It's not that they didn't feel the impact of something that was happening, but it didn't knock them off their center. They experienced it and then returned almost immediately to their sense of stability and well-being. I was thinking 30,000 hours. Now, how many hours of meditation? I figured maybe 10 lifetimes to come. But it is interesting how, and when they were asked to describe what the experience was like for them, and they described it like that it was like the water, that you have waves in the water, which is like what's happening in your daily life, you know, but that doesn't change the nature of the water. And so it was that ability to sort of be there with what is lasting and internal allowed them to go through these great ups and downs without losing that sense of the continuity of existence, I guess. So when they look at resilience, they find that about 30 or 40% of it has to do with our genetic makeup. And that's fixed. Well, somewhat fixed. And only 10% of it actually has to do with our life circumstances. And the other 50 to 60% has to do with attitude. So there is a lot of room for, you know, engagement here. There's a lot that we can do. It can, resilience can be cultivated and nurtured. Our brains and genes are flexible. It used to be thought that, you know, it was all sort of set, that, you know, one, you were who you were. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, actually, neuroplasticity says no, that's not true at all. That you can teach old dogs new tricks, and you can actually train your mind. And I think it's something that in our time is really coming to the forefront. I'll get back into that in a minute. But they've studied the study on the impact of brain of long-term meditation practices using MRIs and brain scans found that the brain showed far more gamma waves, which are associated with insight and altruistic feelings. Epigenetics is another one, that our genes, although you're born with a set of genes, it seems that there's a great, considerable variability about what gets actually turned on and what doesn't. So it's, once again, it's much more malleable than you know, was previously thought. I heard a talk on the radio by a scientist who was, I believe, in Sloan Kettering or one of the hospitals in New York, who was studying psychopaths, and he had been studying them for quite some time and had devised this test, or, you know, a set of characteristics that somebody who was a psychopath would follow. And he'd been doing this research for quite some time. Anyways, they needed some random people. So he was getting family and friends all to do the test. And of course it was all done without names and that sort of thing. And there was one of the random ones that came through that just was over the top in terms of the characteristics of a psychopath, and it turned out to be him. And he then started asking his friends and family, well, you know, does that really, you know, does that really, does that, and they all said, oh yes, you know, those are your characteristics. And so to his credit, he was curious, well, if I have all these characteristics, then why am I not showing this behavior? And he went back to his family, and he realized that at the critical points in life, he had been met with love. And that had actually overridden his genetic predisposition. So I thought that was very interesting. So neuroplasticity and epigenetics may be new concepts in science, but spiritual practices have long advocated the importance of training the mind. Norman Fisher, who is actually he's the guiding teacher now. What is Norman's official?
He's
the guiding teacher for Mount Rain. Anyways, he wrote a book called Training in Compassion, which looks at the Tibetan Lojong practices. There's 57, 59 slogans, which are a sort of practical way of developing compassion in your daily existence. They work on the principle of sort of taking in the suffering or discomfort from the world and processing, sort of breathing it through you and sending out the healing and the light. This, you know, and these practices were first developed in the 12th century. So this, there's nothing new about this, and I'm sure there's many traditions that go further back than that. And the fact that 800 years later, these practices are still every bit as relevant today as they were then. So of all the methods for training the mind, the one that science, psychology, and spiritual practices agree is essential for well-being is, any guesses? Meditation. They all talk about how a period of calming the mind. Now, meditation, it can be much more broadly defined. It can be prayer, it can be contemplation, it can be calming, just sitting by the sea and really letting your thoughts still themselves. But that the need to allow your brain to actually sort of stop, relax, and there's some very interesting things that happen in that. One of the things that they have found is that the brain actually has a mechanism, it's called your glymphatic system, for cleansing itself. And it's a way that the neurotoxins are actually eliminated from the brain. But it is only activated in deep sleep or in periods of meditation. So, you know, so that's one of the, so when you're meditating, you can think about it that way. It's, in point of fact, a way of sort of cleansing your mind. There's a Center for Investigating Healthy Mind, which was set up in 1992 in Madison, Wisconsin, the University of Madison, Wisconsin. And it studies the effects of how our thoughts affect our brain. The person who heads up this institute is Dr. Richard Davidson, and he's a neuroscientist. And he had been exploring how emotional states affect the brain, looking at things like fear and depression and that sort of thing. And in 1992, he visited with the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama said to him, he said, "Well, why don't you study healthy mind states?" It was a very good question. And it was completely life-changing for Dr. Richard Davidson. And that's what he started doing. He teamed up with another man who was also a scientist and a Tibetan monk, a Dr. Matthew Ricard, who you may have heard of. He's also very well known. And they started doing all these tests on people with long, you know, with long practices of meditation, and actually looking at their brains and how things were working. One of the things that they found is that most of our sort of emotions, what is called the executive center of our brain, is in our prefrontal lobes. The left prefrontal lobe is associated with sort of survival instincts. And the right prefrontal lobe is associated with intuition and creativity. Now, I found this particularly interesting myself. Actually, when you wake up in the morning, what will normally happen is that the left prefrontal lobe will be in business, because we are vulnerable animals. And as such, when we wake up, we need to take care of ourselves. We need to make sure that we're safe. Fear is there for a reason, you know. And however, you can actually move your thinking to your to the right prefrontal lobe by being fairly deliberate. And I've been experimenting with this ever since I found it, and I actually find it really works. So the sort of things that you can do is you first of all have to be present and aware of it. Setting an altruistic intent really helps, like thinking about, okay, what am I going to do today that's going to be good for someone else? And it doesn't have to be grand, you know? And then literally give that thought power, you know, okay, today I'm going to give a Dharma talk, and I'm going to invite my friends and my daughter, and we're all going to get together. And pretty soon what you have done is you have moved your thinking into the other lobe, and you then are strengthening those neuroconductors. So you've moved away from the habitual patterns to, so you might want to try that sometime. As I said, I found it very helpful. It's really interesting too, because, you know, as I said, this was set up, this institute was set up in 1992. It has been so influential of what about how we have, how we see how the brain works, and about how you can actually cultivate healthy mind states, that this has been incorporated into the school systems, it's been incorporated into the medical system. We all can get a prescription for an 8-session series on mindfulness through the BC medical plan that is fully paid for. That is so radical that in that period of time, it's actually infiltrated that much that it's actually part of our medical system. Also very helpful. So resilience is based on orienting your life energy into a cooperative, creative, and compassionate ways by training the mind through meditation, skillful actions, and maintaining those on a daily basis. It's why we're here. It's why it's called practice. If anything is to become a habit, it needs reinforcement. It has to be done on a daily basis. Just don't set new patterns in without that. Optimism plays a huge part in resilience. By focusing on the positive, we allow that to be the dominant response to our life. One of the things I've been doing while preparing for this talk is going around and asking everybody, what do they think, where do they see resilience in their life? And I asked my dear friend Kaz, who is a little bit asleep right now, who recently went through an injury. She's broke her collarbone and some ribs and that sort of thing, doing battle with a tree while on a ladder. And I called her, I think it was a couple of days ago, and I asked her how she is. And she said, oh, she said, you know, I'm really very lucky. And I said, well, that quality, she said, I could be dead. She said, you know, if I had landed this way or this had happened, I wouldn't be here, you know. So that ability to reframe or to look at the part of what is happening to you through that sort of lens of, you know, it could have been much worse, or I'm doing okay with this, or maybe I'm just enduring this, but that's all right. You know, so what does resilience mean in the context of our spiritual practice? Confidence is something that I actually did my last talk on. Confidence in our innate enlightened nature or Buddha nature is the spiritual equivalent of radical optimism. You know, that if we are all fully realized beings, there's every reason to be confident. Resilience enables you to use your experience of suffering or dissatisfaction and attachment as a springboard in your practice. It is the energy that enables you to engage and learn from your hindrances as an essential part of the path to liberation. It is the alchemy that turns base metal into gold, doubt into faith, form into emptiness. And I just want to end with two quotes. The first one is from Dogen. Dogen is the 12th century founder of our Soto Zen lineage. And this is from the Fukan Zazenji. You have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not use your time in vain. You are maintaining the essential working of the Buddha way. And this second one is from Thet Nhat Hanh, and this comes from his book, Understanding Our Mind, 50 verses on the nature of consciousness. And the last verse states, when we realize that afflictions are no other than enlightenment, we can ride the waves of birth and death in peace, traveling in the boat of compassion on the ocean of delusion, smiling the smile of no fear. So we're going to take a few minutes and have a discussion. This is going to be your chance to talk about this in smaller groups. So I'll tell you the question, then I'll talk a little bit about the format. So what I'd like you to do is think of a challenging situation that you faced. How did you meet it? And what enabled you to be resilient? Or where did you find resilience in yourself? And so we're going to form into groups of about three people. So you'll just gather together within that group. And the general rules are that each person will get 3 minutes to talk. And there'll be a bell at the beginning and the end. So just give it a little bow. And if you don't have 3 minutes worth of things that you want to say, well, you can be silent. Everybody can just, you know, be quiet while that happens. It's not meant to be crosstalk, you know. So each person will take a time, but don't reference the other person. Talk about yourself. And the other thing is that what is said here needs to stay here. That's really important if people are to feel that they're what they're saying is being respected and their vulnerability will not be. So don't talk about it at tea, please. And if this question, I'll go over it again. Think of a challenging situation that you've faced. How did you greet it or meet it? And what enabled you to be resilient, or where do you find resilience in you? And if you want to talk about something else in your 3 minutes, that's okay too. Good. So.